Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let's start with the hood. Bill Belichick. Belichick met with the media for the first time after the Antonio Brown lawsuit was filed. And Belichick handled it exactly the way that you would expect him to handle it.
Are you preparing for him to play on Sunday?
We're taking it one day at a time, just like we always do.
Are you preparing for the possibility that he could be on the commissioner's
We're preparing for one day at a time.
How much weight would the allegations against him weigh into whether or not you play him on Sunday?
Yeah, I appreciate all the questions, and that's what's been said has been said.
Bill, you brought up Randy Moss yesterday. Do you think that Antonio Brown will require as much attention as Moss did to get him in sync with the team?
Yeah, I didn't say that.
I'm asking you.
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't know if he'll require more attention?
No.
How difficult or frustrating is it to have a distraction like this right at the beginning of the season when you?
Yeah, we're working on Miami. We're working on Miami. The rest of it is, we're on Miami.
You know, there may have been a time when Bill Belichick said things like, "We're on to Cincinnati."
We're on to Cincinnati.
You know, and there may have been a time when people thought that was kind of funny, kind of cool, or that it was just classic hood, old man Belichick, just being locked in on football, always looking to the next thing. Except this isn't that. One of your players, somebody you just signed, has been accused of three separate incidents of sexual assault. Saying you're working on Miami is not going to cut it. Not here. And just because everyone expected that he would handle it like this does not mean that it's okay when he does handle it like this. Like, nobody would be expecting Belichick or any head coach or front office person in that situation to be completely open in a press conference like that. I understand there are ongoing legal issues that he can't discuss, but there are questions that he can answer. And on top of that, he can deal with it in a way that is professional and not the way in which he did it, which is frankly like an a-hole. Like treating every question about the star that you just signed, who's just been accused of sexual assault, is somehow out of bounds or inappropriate. This is your problem now. And if you're pissed off that it's your problem, that's fine. I get that. But it is your problem. And the only people you have to blame for that are yourselves. Roughly 24 hours earlier, you were chastising the media for asking the same questions when Randy Moss was signed. Now it's time to answer those questions. Like, I'm sorry if those questions are awkward or they're uncomfortable, but you don't get to give a long statement about preparing for the Dolphins, grunt a few answers about Antonio Brown, snap at reporters, and then leave in a huff. In other words, do your job. Isn't that what you tell everybody in that building? Do your job. So do yours, Hood. Here's a quick recap of events. Antonio Brown threatens to punch a team official in Oakland. Antonio Brown is released in Oakland. Antonio Brown signs with New England. Antonio Brown is sued for sexual assault. Antonio Brown practices with the Patriots. When that's the timeline, there are going to be some questions. Some of which I understand that you legally can answer, and some of which you cannot. But all of which deserve more than the grunting and the general smugness that's been applied to the entire process with Brown and the Patriots. I mean, that smugness was weird when he was signed. It's even more weird now that he's been accused of sexual assault. And yes, again, there are questions that can be answered that would not mess with the ongoing legal issues. You know, like the question of whether or not the team knew about this before they signed him. Multiple reporters who are plugged into the league have reported that the Patriots were surprised by the lawsuit. All right, fine. That would indicate that the Patriots, or at least some inside the Patriots, inside, really want the world to know that they didn't know about this before signing him. I mean, reporters have it, right? So they want you to know that. Fine. Say it on the record. Put your name on that. Put your face on that. Make it official. Just say it. We didn't know. because Brown's agent said yesterday, quote, Antonio and I have been unfortunately anticipating this possibility, end quote, of a lawsuit. So if he said that he and his client were anticipating it, were the Patriots also anticipating it? Did Brown's agent not tell the Patriots? Did they not ask? Or did they ask and did they not care? And Belichick was not alone. Tom Brady was also there to embarrass himself as well.
Getting right to it, Tom. Do you have any comment at all on the Antonio Brown allegations that are out there?
No.
Not a word to say?
Didn't I just answer that?
Do you think it'll be a distraction at all for your team going forward? I know you guys have dealt with so much through your whole career. You personally, the whole team, you've been through stuff like this before, I guess. So how do you put it aside?
I'm just trying to show up and play football and try to prepare. Miami's a good team. I'm going to get ready for them, and things that don't involve me, don't involve me.
First of all, Miami is not a good team. Miami is one of the worst teams I've ever seen. But as with Belichick, it was exactly what you'd expect, right? Nothing. Nothing, and yet it said a lot. Like, you don't get to pretend to be a great leader only in the good times. If you want to be a guy to tweet out hashtag LFG or some other crap, he's the man. But if you want someone to answer tough questions, yeah, that's not happening. In fact, he'll give you a smart response like, didn't I just answer that? And then try to pawn it off with, quote, things that don't involve me, don't involve me.
Things that don't involve me, don't involve me.
Tom. Hey, Tommy. Thomas. They don't involve you? Didn't you invite that same guy to stay in your house? Wasn't that the story? If that's the story, and it's true, then Antonio Brown does involve you. You've involved yourself with him, and he's involved with you. You can't be all about that guy 1 minute and then claim that he doesn't involve you another. I'm surprised Brady didn't just say, Antonio Brown. Never heard of that guy. Actually, you know what? That name does sound kind of familiar, but I can't quite place it. Look, same thing as with Belichick. I'm not expecting this guy to pour his heart out for a mic, heart and soul, but don't be so completely weird and disingenuous. I mean, shock us. Be a leader about it. Acknowledge that it is concerning news. Acknowledge that it looks really weird that you were 100%, no, 1,000%, no, 1,000,000% in on Antonio Brown. You said as much. And now he's been accused of sexual assault. Say something about how serious the situation is and how concerned you are for everybody involved. And are you still 1,000,000% in on this guy? Because if you are, say that. And if you aren't, say that. Just don't do what you did. Namely, duck out the back at the first sign of trouble. I mean, how is it that the guy who is the smartest, most knowledgeable quarterback ever doesn't know any words here? The guy who tells everybody he has all the answers to the test when he's on the field, but he's got no answers to some pretty basic questions off it. I mean, it's weak. It's weak. Special teams captain, Matthew Slater, for instance, acted like a leader. He didn't say much, but he showed a level of humanity and recognition of the gravity of the situation. Belichick and Brady are acting like it's the biggest hassle ever. Like the people asking legitimate questions were a major hassle. If Belichick did not bring Antonio Brown onto the team, and if Brady did not bring Antonio Brown into his house, allegedly, then it wouldn't be their problem. But they did. And it is. So, be real about it. Your problem is not with the people asking the questions. It's with the answers that you have to come up with. And with the guy you brought in. That's your problem. We're not the problem. We are joined by PJ Fleck. PJ, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing elite, Jim. Thanks for having us on the show.
I knew you'd say that. I knew it. All right, so you're coming off that huge road win at Fresno State. You're 2-0 to start the season. I know you've got Georgia Southern coming up, but take me back, PJ, to Fresno State for a moment. You were going on the road to face a team that won 12 games last year. They gave USC all they could handle in the first week. How did you go about getting you guys ready for that game and for that challenge?
Well, we played them last year as well, and they ended up 18th in the country. It came down to the final play last year at home at TCF Bank Stadium here in Minneapolis, and And we knew what kind of team they were going to be. Jeff Tedford's a really good football coach, and we knew they'd be prepared, and we knew they couldn't wait to get us back into their stadium. And it was a tremendous football game. Could have went either way. I think people understand how good Fresno State is, but especially around here, it's hard to be able to say, you know, because they're not Power 5, how good are they? They're a really good football team. And towards the end, I mean, our team showed their courage, their character, and our culture, and they found a way to win. And it was more of a refuse-to-lose mentality than just wanting to win. And we had to rely on other playmakers who maybe haven't made some plays in the past to make them, and they did. And our guys found a way to win.
Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Do not make a shake or eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty. It's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business. It takes smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? No one. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned is sweetened with a touch of brown sugar goodness, teriyaki, peppered, and hot and spicy for those of you who like to take things up a notch. So, the next time you want a great protein and energy snack, you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. Clones, if you don't see it, just ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Minnesota head football coach P.J. Fleck is joining us once again. You know, you find a way to win, and it seems to me also you weren't looking for just a nice comeback and then a loss in overtime. Of course, you trade touchdowns in the first overtime. You kick a field goal to take the lead in the second overtime before Antoine Winfield Jr. ended the game with his interception. What was going through you on that play, and how big of a moment was that for the program?
Well, they made a great play call, and the tight end, kind of a delay, wide delay, comes across the field and then runs a wheel. A lot of NFL teams have it. A lot of college teams have it. We have it. It's a really good play call, and Antoine Winfield Jr. takes a post at the safety position and then passes it off to the other safety and then whirls around and makes the play in the air. It's an unbelievable play. It does exactly what he's supposed to do, but not only that, high points the football, cuts in front of the receiver, and then not only that, goes down for downtime. But we knew if we could be able to get him to throw the football, we'd be able to hopefully be able to make a play in the air, and our playmakers stepped up and made plays. You know, you need your players and your leaders and your best players to come through in the biggest moments. And Antoine Winfield Jr. is one of our best players, and he came through in that moment.
It's not like he hasn't done it before. In fact, that's the second straight year that Winfield's had a huge play against Fresno State. He has battled some injuries over the past 2 years. So what's it say about him that he keeps on fighting to get better and to play with his teammates?
Well, that's what Row the Boat's all about. It's just a never-give-up type mentality, his resiliency, a type of player he is. He comes from NFL bloodlines. You know, his father played so long in the NFL. So he understands football's part, being hurt's part of football, and you go through different things like that in football, and sometimes that happens to you. His response has just been absolutely incredible. It's been inspiring for our football team. And when he's on the field, we're a way better football team. And he knows that. Our players know that. And the play he made last week was unbelievable. Last year was unbelievable. But when you talk about Fresno, I mean, this is a team that beat UCLA, that beat Arizona State, that came down to almost beating USC 2 weeks ago, almost beating us. Very, very good football team.
P.J. Fleck joining us. You mentioned Row the Boat. You know, I'd ask you what's better than coming on the road or going on the road, coming from behind, winning a game in double OT, but how great is it then to go back to the locker room, celebrate with your team, and have John Legend join you guys to crowd surf and yell, "Row the Boat"? What was that like?
Yeah, well, we didn't tell our team that he was coming. Michael Brown Stevens is his nephew who's on our football team, and, you know, we got it all through compliance and the NCAA about John Legend being there and different things that he would have to need. And so, but I didn't really tell our team that because I didn't want the added pressure of some type of celebrity like that, and a person that all of them listened to be there, put that added pressure. But I knew that if we could win, we could get him in the locker room somehow, some way at the end and address him, because that's an exciting moment memory that those players will always remember, not just the comeback victory, but have John Legend in the locker room. And to have him say "Row the Boat," even though he is a Buckeye, that was a nice three words coming out of his mouth.
That is cool. P.J. Fleck joining us. All right, so you're two games into your third season. How far has the program come in the time since you've arrived?
Well, I think we're getting there. You know, our culture is ever evolving and changing every single day. It's becoming more of a player-led team. And we talk about that, you know, bad teams, nobody leads, average teams, coaches lead, and elite teams, players lead. This team is becoming more player-led. There's still about 80% of our football team that's still freshmen and sophomores. We're still really young, but the culture is really setting in. You know, it's not just my culture anymore. It's not the coach's culture anymore. It's our program's culture and the player's culture, and that's where we're really developing into in year three.
We're talking to P.J. Fleck. You know, you closed out last season with that huge win at Wisconsin, and then you had a blowout win over Georgia Tech in the bowl game. I understand that every season's different, but how much did those wins say about the growth of the program, and did that momentum carry over into the offseason?
Well, I think every season's its own entity. I don't really believe in carrying over momentum from one year to the next because it is its own individual entity and individual season. But one thing I will say is it brings validity. You know, everybody's looking for validity with a new coach, a new culture, no matter what program you're in the first few years. And you have to be able to provide that in the first few years or you start to lose support pretty quick. And I felt like the end of last year, of the last four games that we played, we were able to provide proof of what we were able to do with the youngest team in America. We were doing things that hadn't been done since 1994, beating Wisconsin at Camp Randall in a very convincing way and having a very convincing win over Purdue and winning our bowl game by the largest margin of victory in the history of the program. So when you're able to do that with the youngest team in America, with a lot of freshmen playing, it starts to show that here's what we're going to do, here's where we're going into the future, and it starts to bring that validity to our fans, to our alumni, to our state, and to our administration that here's our plan, here's what it looks like, and it starts to show the proof.
Minnesota head football coach P.J. Fleck is joining us here in the jungle. Now, you've talked about how you like to have a theme for the season. This year, it's connected to movies. What's the theme, and what's the thinking behind it?
Well, the thing is to keep it fun. You know, football is fun. I think sometimes we lose track of that. We coach because we love to educate and teach, and we love the game of football. We coach a game for a living, and, you know, these are 2019 millennials. It's a different generation than maybe you and I were when we were growing up. And whatever's new today is old tomorrow, and everything's instant. And, you know, you got to keep things fresh. So to keep their focus, you know, we talk about a movie each week. And last week it was Indiana Jones. And we talked about how, because we had to go out west. Well, he travels everywhere, whether it's Egypt or wherever he's going. I mean, he can go out there and do it. And he doesn't have all these weapons at times. He's got to be smarter, and he's got to be able to find a better way to do things. And so we really just kind of connect ourselves with a movie that's based on what we need to be able to do to win. And it just keeps it fresh every single week. It really kind of separates what happened the week before to what's happening this week, really draws a line in the sand so you can separate it so there's no overlap. And that's what we're working on doing.
We're talking to P.J. Fleck. Now, P.J., you and I have talked so many times over the years, and we always talk about language. One of the words that keeps coming up now is the word how. The word how. Why is that an important word to you as a coach?
Well, because it doesn't really matter what your title is or what you do. I mean, a lot of people get put in a position, whether they earned it or not, they have a title. And I think we value so many titles in our society, maybe overvalue titles. It's how you do your job. It's how you do something. It's how you live your life. It's the story of your life. It's the Necton mentality, Prefontaine Pace, Farmers Alliance, the unconquerable will, your heart, your spirit, your passion, your want to. That's why football is one of the greatest games ever. Because it doesn't matter how big or tall or strong or fast you are, if you don't have the will, the unconquerable will to be the best player and the best teammate you can be, your team's not going to be the best team. And we keep focusing on the word how, the best we possibly can, how we do things matters, because on Saturdays, usually the best team finds a way to win. And we might not have all the five-star recruits in the world, that's okay, but we need to find a way to become the best team every single week that happens to be on the field on Saturdays.
P.J. Fleck, my guest, for a couple more moments. Now, in the offseason, you had a couple of assistants join other programs. One was going back to his alma mater. The other received an assistant head coaching job. Seems to me a lot of head coaches might not like that, but you're in favor of that. You want your guys to move on. So how much pride do you take in growing the tree, so to speak, and then taking the row the boat culture to other places?
Well, I love it. I love when our assistants, go chase their dreams. And there's two types of people. There's one that allow other people's dreams to happen, and there's others that you make your own dream happen. You know, and when you're an assistant coach, you're helping a head coach make his dream possible, right, by supporting him and doing everything you can to help him become the best head coach he can be. And you're helping each other. You know, my job as a head coach is to serve my assistant. I know that sounds crazy because you think it's the other way around, but I do everything I can to make them the best they possibly can be and take whatever they can possibly take from me and then move on with that. I want them to grow, learn. I want guys to be head coaches. You know, when I interview coaches, I ask them, where do you want to be? What are your dreams? What are your goals? How can I help you? if you come work for me. And most of them say, I want to be a head coach. I said, I can help you do that. And I want you to do that. And I want you to learn as much as you possibly can about how I run a program and how we run a program. And you're going to like things and probably not like things. And I want you to take that with you and then go somewhere else and continue to grow your tree. And then take the row the boat culture with you of serving and giving somehow, some way, put it in the back of your mind and use it to however you want to use it into the future. But I love hiring really young assistants, giving them their shot, doing what we can to develop them throughout all the stages, academically, athletically, socially, and spiritually throughout our program, and then having their dreams go come true somewhere else as well. And if they can come true here, we want them to stay as long as they possibly want. I love when our assistants stay, but I also understand when they need to go. And I think some people, we hold on too tight at times, but I never want to limit my staff. I want their dreams to come true, and that's one thing we constantly preach in our program.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So a quick follow-up. You obviously want your players to grow and improve. You want your staff to grow and improve. But at the same time, you're looking to do the same thing yourself. So how different are you as a coach now than when you first arrived at Minnesota?
I think I'm way different. I think Heather's really helped me become the best person I can be, and the best husband and the best father, the best coach. My staff has helped me do that. I think I'm way more aware of everything that happens in the program. I think that I'm a lot more comfortable with my coordinators and really can take care of the culture. I consider myself the cultural coach. And, you know, I don't let a lot of the smaller things at times bother me as much. We have a certain way of how we do things and how we respond to different events. But I think I'm a little bit more poised than I've used to be. You're obviously more experienced, and I think the more experience you have, the more you can keep changing. And I think you're ever evolving. You know, I meet with a lot of coaches in the off season. There's a lot of coaches I continue to meet with every single year, and we talk about how we're evolving, how we're changing, what we're doing differently with the times. But I think that if you're not changing, you're going to get passed. You know, football is different in 2019 than it was in 2009. And I mean from everything, from recruiting to the practice schedules to conditioning to how you treat your student athletes to the experiences they have to the moments and memories they create. I want them to create these moments and memories because nothing lasts forever. Whether it's me being a head coach or them being student athletes, nothing lasts forever. So if we can create those moments and memories through experiences they have, that's our job as educators.
PJ Fleck, what a great conversation. Minnesota Golden Gophers head coach in his third season there. They are 2-0 on the season, coming off that win in double OT over Fresno State and hosting Georgia Southern Saturday. PJ, I appreciate you and that conversation as always. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Jim. Row the boat, Sky Mile, go Gophers. Thanks a lot.
Remember when Justify won the 150th Belmont Stakes last June to finish off that Triple Crown? Remember what an amazing moment that was.
And they're into the stretch, and Justify comes roaring home to a raucous Belmont Park with one furlong to run. Gronkowski and Hofberg trying to run him down. Vito Rosso is fourth, a 16th to go. Justify is still there. Justify from Gronkowski. He's just perfect, and now he's just immortal. Justify is the 13th Triple Fourth.
And that was as good as that sounded. That was an amazing moment. Except it turns out maybe that should have never happened. Because according to a bombshell the New York Times dropped late yesterday, Justify failed a drug test 1 month before the Kentucky Derby. So that means that Justify was running in the Derby weeks after a failed drug test. So that would kind of change that story a little bit, right? Kind of change how the Derby win feels. Not only changes how that Derby win feels, but might eliminate the Triple Crown conversation altogether. And then that undoubtedly would impact the sale of his breeding rights, which reportedly went for $60 million. Because the real money in that sport is not made in racing and purses, but rather in breeding. Having the 13th winner of the Triple Crown connected to a drug scandal is bad. Really bad. But it gets worse. Because according to the New York Times, the rules of the sport were not followed. According to this report, and I quote, instead of the failed drug test causing a speedy disqualification, the California Horse Racing Board took more than a month to confirm the results. Then, instead of filing a public complaint, as it usually does, the board made a series of decisions behind closed doors as it moved to drop the case and lighten the penalty for any horse found to have the banned substance that Justify tested positive for in its system, end quote. So that's not good. That's really, really not good.
Below not good.
The story goes on to lay out that on April 7th, 2018, Justify won the Santa Anita Derby and then tested positive for scopolamine. Scopolamine can help clear a horse's airway, which would help its heart rate. Now, here's where it gets a little sketchy, possibly. Scopolamine can also be found in Jimson weed, which in turn can be found in the horse's food, which makes rulings related to scopolamine a little tricky. Now, normal procedure at that point would be to strip the win, the prize money, and the spot in the Derby, because the horse had to finish first or second in the Santa Anita Derby to get to the Kentucky Derby. But the horse was not stripped. That did not happen. Instead, according to the New York Times, regulators waited 3 weeks until shortly before the Derby to alert trainer Bob Baffert to the failed test. As is allowed, Baffert requested another sample be tested. And then 3 days after Justify won the Derby, the second test confirmed the first test. But then things get weird. Instead of taking action right then, which would involve the filing of a complaint and a hearing, nothing happened. According to the New York Times, in August, again I quote, 4 months later and more than 2 months after Justify, Baffert and the horse's owners celebrated their Triple Crown victory in New York. The board disposed of the inquiry altogether during a closed-door executive session. It decided, with little evidence, that the positive test could have been a result of Justify's eating contaminated food. The board voted unanimously to dismiss the case. In October, it changed the penalty for a violation to a lesser penalty of a fine and a possible suspension. End of quote. So, in truth, it's probably not accurate to say that the matter would have been resolved by the running of the Derby. However, not following normal procedures, waiting 4 months after the test and 2 months after the Triple Crown was won, and then dismissing the case behind closed door is not good. The optics are terrible. It's horrible. In fact, it looks really bad. Now, there might be a good reason for it, but there better be an awesome explanation, because what it looks like to any casual observer is that the failed drug test was buried. And here's another question. Why did it take so long for this to come out? Why are we only now hearing about this, nearly a year and a half after the failed test and more than a year after the case was dismissed? You know, I guess maybe the failed test really was the result of contaminated food. But that excuse never holds a lot of water when it comes to boxers who try and sell that, or cyclists who try to blame tainted beef. So, people obviously are going to reach the conclusion that horse racing went all Bud Selig on it and ignored cheating in order to allow an exciting result. Because by the time that case was dismissed, Justify had won the Triple Crown and his breeding rights had been sold for $60 million. As I mentioned earlier in the take, the real money in that game is not won in racing, but in breeding. And even more incredibly than $60 million, those who have those rights have reportedly already made that money back. He currently receives as much as $150,000 per mating. Or in horse parlance, he stands for $150,000. They can mate 3 times a day during season. That's $450,000 per day over a 5-month season. And you see where the money is. They've already made that money back, reportedly. Now, as you know, I've owned racehorses. We still own Janet and I, a couple of racehorses. We own a couple of horses that are in training. We own some retired horses. We own one baby that has not started to train yet. And I've had some amazing times in horse racing. And I've had some of the worst times of my life in horse racing. Gut-wrenching times in the sport. When horse racing is good, it's glorious. And when it's bad, it's horrible. And I'll be real. I love it when it's great. But I'll be real when I say this. Like any other sport, it's got issues. Serious issues. Issues that need to be addressed. And for anybody who cares about that sport, and for anybody who cares about the animal, this is bad. Because it takes one of the greatest moments in recent memory, and it puts it in a really bad light. And there are a ton of questions, and people should start coming forward with some good answers. This is not a new idea right here, but it's the most important one. Horse racing needs unified and uniform rules to govern the entire sport. They can't just go track by track. They can't go state by state. They can't go with each entity making up its own rules. They can't have governing bodies with inherent conflicts of interest. So instead of doing what the sport always does, nothing, and just hoping that it blows over and everybody moves on to the next thing, the sport needs to take a hard line. It needs to make a stand. A stand for honesty. A stand for integrity. And unless this changes, the sport does remain in grave danger of existing as we know it. Because again, when it's good, it's great. And when it's bad, it's really bad. And this is really bad. Prepare for your road trips. Before your travel begins, visit O'Reilly Auto Parts. Simple preventative maintenance before you go will ensure a safe journey. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. He is Jason Lockenfora, JLC. Good to have you back. How are you?
It's good to be back. You could have just stopped at first guest ever, but you know.
My man.
It's your show, so it's your call.
My man, I appreciate that. Listen, I'm going to see you on Sunday, but I wanted to catch up with you in advance. Let's start with Antonio Brown and the Patriots. What do you make, Jason, of how everything has unfolded since his release from the Raiders right on through today?
I don't know. I think my head is still spinning a little bit, Jim. Just kind of trying to take in what has been a dizzying whirlwind. Only a matter of weeks, feels like months at times, covering on a moment-by-moment basis. I don't know that I've seen anything quite like this before, and now, obviously, with the allegations against him, that things are in a completely different sphere than anything related to helmets or feet or, his mutiny or whatever to get out of Oakland. So, you know, we'll have to see here what the league does. That there's, two individuals involved in this, and I think only those two know the exact nature of their relationship. I don't know how this is going to play out. The league is still very much at the beginning of its investigation. Could they use the, at some point in time, the commissioner's list exemption there to basically pay him to stay away from the team while it's investigated? We've seen that in the past. I have not been told that any decision's been made on that just yet. In the meantime, he's practicing with the Patriots, and that's sort of where it stands.
Jason Lockenfora joining us. To that point, is it too soon to tell, Jason? What, if anything, do you expect the league office to do as it relates to Brown?
I don't have an expectation, honestly, Jim. I don't know anything about this case other than what's in the complaint and what's in the lawyer statement and what's in the Patriots statement. And we'll have to see, I guess, where this investigation goes, how much evidence there is. I guess they want to, the league will sit down with Brittany Taylor at some point here and discuss the situation with her. That's likely to happen next week. Antonio Brown says that, through his agent, Drew Rosenhaus, that he'll cooperate completely and fully. I don't know where it's going, Jim. At this point, it's a civil matter and not a criminal matter. We've got certain district attorneys saying they'll look into it, whatever that exactly means. One thing I have learned with Antonio Brown is don't really set expectations, you know, or just in general, not even regard to this case, but just him and sort of the whirlwind that he's been since he left Pittsburgh. Like, expect the unexpected.
Jason Lockenfor is my guest. You know, one more thought. Since you mentioned Drew Rosenhaus, in an interview yesterday, Jason, Drew Rosenhaus said that he and Antonio Brown have been anticipating the possibility of a lawsuit. How likely is it that they would or would not have mentioned that to the Patriots?
I honestly don't know. The Patriots aren't talking about that element of this. Drew Rosenhaus isn't talking about, you know, that element of this. There wasn't a lot of time. Now, there's definitely people who are kind of looking at the whole timeline of how quickly he ended up with the Patriots anyway. And you know, as I reported in the NFL Today over the weekend, there's a lot of raised eyebrows and a lot of suspicious GMs about, you know, how quickly that came together. But given that it is a fairly complicated contract, especially for a short-term contract, and it has some unique language, and there were other teams interested, you know, if you take Drew Rosenhaus at his word, which is, I didn't start this process until, you know, the player was released and I was allowed to start the process. I don't know. I mean, it was done in a matter of hours. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And there were other things going on in Drew Rosenhaus's life and other things going on in the New England Patriots organization. So I don't know just logistically, you know what I mean, how much, and you're talking about an issue of this magnitude, you know what I mean? I don't know how much you could have gone into it.
Jason Lockenfora joining us. All right, so the Patriots do not want to talk about Antonio Brown, but they would love to talk all about the Miami Dolphins. According to reports, Jason, a lot of Dolphins do not want to be Dolphins. When you look at everybody who left in the offseason, either in free agency or by trade, is there anybody else who could still go, or is that fire sale already over?
Yeah, my reporting on that situation doesn't lead me anywhere close to what was initially reported last Sunday night. You know, they've had a rocky tenure there. There's been a lot of things that have gone awry. Jim Caldwell, you know, unfortunate health situation. You're firing the offensive line coach, you know, like a week into camp. There's certainly been some head scratchers, and I'm not going to tell you it's all completely warm and fuzzy. But, like, look at the roster, you know. There's only five guys making more than $5 million. One of them's Ryan Fitzpatrick. Like, he knew what he was signing on for. You know, Xavien Howard's their highest paid player. He just did the deal in May. You know, he knew what was going on. Like, you know, like, it's not like a shock to him that the Dolphins aren't world beaters this year. There's not many tradable guys on the roster. The one guy, you know, Rashad Jones, if he could get out of there and they could get him out of there, would that make some sense? Yeah, but at over $13 million for a guy who hasn't played much the last couple of years, you know, teams have sniffed around, but they're looking to get him for free. So, no, I would say much ado about nothing and not much to see there. They're going to be bad. They're going to lose a lot of games, and they're going to do it primarily with the crew that's there right now.
Right now, you and I spoke right after the Ravens had drafted Lamar Jackson. You were making it very clear how significant you thought that pick was for that organization. What do you make of what you saw from him in week one?
I mean, that's an absolute tour de force. That's, you know, maximum Lamar. You're not going to get that every week. You don't get maximum Mahomes every week. You know what I mean? We didn't get maximum Joe Montana every week. I mean, certain things fall into line. It's a perfect storm. They unleash things on Miami that Miami wasn't ready for, and they've all these new weapons, Hollywood Brown, Boykin, you know, even getting Hayden Hurst. People forget, Lamar wasn't even their first draft pick in that draft. They took Hayden Hurst first. He pretty much was a medical redshirt most of last year, even when he was on the field. He still had that plate in his foot. He wasn't right. He should be an explosive tight end. He already clicked with Mark Andrews last year, did Lamar. So it's not going to be like that every week, but it could be like that many weeks. And I'm not buying that it had everything to do with Miami not being very good. Go look at Miami's secondary. Over 25% of their salary cap is tied to the starting secondary. And there's dudes there who have balled big time in college, and a lot of them have done it in the NFL. I mentioned Howard's payday. They were getting eviscerated. Like, they were, and I get it, wasn't a great pass rush, yada, yada, yada. But Baltimore's offense is going to be a thing to behold. It's different than everybody else. They're going to run the ball in different ways than even we saw week one. And if they have a real pass rush, or even a semblance of a real pass rush, then they're a team that could win a Super Bowl. Frankly, my concerns, and I've written about this all offseason, are more with the secondary pass rush options besides Matt Judon than it is anything with the offense, because Lamar is the real deal.
We're talking to Jason Lockenfora. Meantime, former Ravens QB Joe Flacco was not exactly a tour de force in making his debut for the Broncos on Monday night. How did he look to you?
I mean, that's just who Joe Flacco is, and it's who he has been really since his body, you know, since he started getting hurt, and not minor stuff. You know what I mean? He had a significant back injury. He had, you know, the knee tear, which, you know, the incredible consecutive game started streak. He has the ACL tear. He comes back, it's a back, then the next year it's a hip labrum thing. Like, these aren't, mild hamstrings. So I think his body has started to break down. The long ball that we remember him, for, and especially in that crazy playoff run where that ended up with him being a Super Bowl MVP, that's just not who he is anymore. It's a lot of checkdowns. It's one of the lowest yard attempt in the league, and it's the most road interceptions in the NFL since he won that Super Bowl MVP award. And, you know, I think that's who the Broncos were getting to get a four for him and have the Broncos assume the whole contract was a coup for the Ravens, because they were obviously going in another direction, and specifically behind that offensive line and with not the greatest skill guys in the history of the world. I just think it's not going to be pretty offensively for the Broncos this year.
We are talking to Jason Lockenfora for a couple of more moments. GLC, the Chargers beat the Colts on Sunday, and they did so without Melvin Gordon. Austin Eckler had a big performance in Gordon's absence. But where do things stand now with Gordon and that contract?
Nothing's changed. I don't anticipate much changing in the short term. He has to come back by November. In order to play football at all this year, he's sitting out the entire year really gains him nothing financially, and certainly in terms of free agency status. And he doesn't gain any freedom. The Chargers still have his rights for multiple years if they wanted to include a franchise tag. So he's going to play. He'll probably come back at some point late October, early November. If the Chargers continue to, I will say this though, like Eckler looked great, but like Mike Williams is dinged up now. And the tight end's out, at least a month. It could be a lot more. Again, the left tackle has been hurt. The offensive line doesn't look great on paper right now. And we know their history with injuries. Unfortunately for them, it's about as bad as it gets, and it just seems to keep happening. So 3 weeks from now, we could be talking about a whole different set of circumstances in which maybe all of a sudden Melvin Gordon has more leverage. But right now, things kind of are what they are.
Right. You mentioned the tight end. Hunter Henry goes down again. That is a brutal blow for them. Listen, one last thought before you go. The Jets, Jason, have ruled out Sam Darnold with mono. What was your reaction to the news? And then when you couple that with Le'Veon Bell needing an MRI,
yeah,
and the fact that they're already missing other key players, how bad of a start is this for the Jets?
It's rough, man. And they're getting a Browns team that probably feels like it's not a must-win game, but it's a big game for the Cleveland Browns for week two. It's just something in Florham Park. I mentioned the Chargers and sort of their injury situation with the Jets. They're just and a lot of times it is of their own making. They haven't been a well-run franchise, but it's just like there's always another shoe dropping somewhere there, it seems. It's going to be tough, man. You could make a case at various points in the offseason. You could compare some of their skill guys with other teams, and you look at what Adam Gase has done at times in his career, and you could say, you know what, there's going to be a breakthrough. And I was buying that for a while. I didn't know about sustainability, but this year, catching some people by surprise, and the schedule does get easier in the second half, but, I mean, if there's no Le'Veon Bell and there's no Sam Darnold and there's no Quincy Enunwa is already out for the year, some other guys are nicked up, it's going to be tough.
Bad things, bad start. He is an NFL insider for CBS Sports and CBSSports.com. He appears every Sunday on the NFL Today on CBS. Jason, looking forward to seeing you at Sunday in New York City. Thanks for coming back on first, and I will see you then.
My pleasure. Safe travels, brother. See you then.
Bud, you too. JLC. I want to get kind of caught up on this clock. Let me just finish this thought on Gardner Minshew the second. And again, there is no first before it gets too far away. So I mentioned the guy comes off the bench. Nick Foles goes down and he completes his first 13 passes, an NFL record. And then he finishes the game 22 of 25. The only three incompletions were credited as drops. And this guy's rolling in like it's nothing at all. But as he mentioned, part of his philosophy is sometimes you have to have a bit of just screw it. So seeing him at his press conference yesterday, did that seem like a guy who's about to make his first NFL start? Because now he is. Did that seem like a guy who was in awe of the situation? Did that seem like a guy who was sweating anything at all? Hell, as he just realized Not so much, because he is now the longest tenured Jags quarterback in the Jags QB room.
Yeah, that's what, man, I was joking out there. I was like, dang, I've been here longer than anybody right there. Like, that's kind of crazy. Like, they're asking me questions. I'm like, golly. But no, it's awesome, man. Great, great guys, young guys. We have a lot of fun. Look forward to, you know, challenging each other, helping each other, and, you know, winning games together.
That's why I love this guy so much. He's making his first NFL start. He's a rookie. He's got to come right in. I mean, shouldn't that guy be tripping? Shouldn't that guy be stressed out? He's just laughing. He's having a great time. He loves it. Like, all of a sudden, I realized I'm the most tenured guy in the quarterback room. They're asking me questions. And then most importantly, he even gave a shout out to all of us communications majors.
Oh, I don't know. He's kind of in his own deal. I got a communications degree. I mean, I know all y'all know about it. Yeah, so, shoot. I belong in this room more than that one.
I belong in this room more. Like he's saying, I should be more like you. I'm more one of you than I am one of them. Normally, I hate that local fawning media or national fawning media. But had I been in that room, I would have been up front laughing and guffawing with the rest of them. Man, the dude is so cool and he's so funny. I mean, hell yes. Way to be, Beowulf. The Gardner Minshew II train is pulling out of the station right about now. Either get on or get the hell off. If you're thinking about getting on, do it right now. Because as Gardner Minshew II himself would say, sometimes you got to have a little bit of screw it. And this dude already is a legend. He came on this show last year, and this is so 2018, but we talked about the power that lies within the stash.
Oh, the power of the stash is unparalleled. It's something else. It has a life of its own.
All right, so who are some of the mustaches that came before you that you respected?
But then, you know, ultimately, the greatest of all time of mustaches, my personal icon, Burt Reynolds. Rest in peace. That is definitely he is the gold standard when it comes to mustaches.
I mean, so you knew right then how cool that guy was. And again, this goes back to Mike Leach saying, hey, listen, do you want to go be a backup quarterback at Alabama? Or would you like to lead the nation in passing? And Gardner Minshew II said that. I'll take that. So he went there and he did that. And paid homage to the GOAT, Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds did have the best stash. Michael Brantley is my guest. Michael, it's been a minute or two, but it's great to have you back on the show. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Great. Listen, can you go back to the offseason first? When you signed with Houston, I know how pumped manager A.J. Hinch was to bring you in. What was it like for you, and how excited were you to have the opportunity to be with this team?
Yeah, I was very excited. You know, one of the first things I sought out for in free agency was having a chance to win and go into a contender that had a potential to go to the World Series. He worked so hard throughout the whole season. You know, the goal is to get to that postseason and ultimately, you know, win a ring. And I ended up here in Houston. They welcomed me with open arms, and kind of just went from there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm curious what it's like, because you're an incredibly well-respected guy around Major League Baseball, but at the same time, as you've said, Cleveland was all you had known. So what's it like when you walk into a new clubhouse with new teammates for the first time?
Yeah, it was really different for me. I never had that situation. I got traded in the minor leagues, never in the major leagues. So it was just a different atmosphere. But at the same time, when I walked in, you know, the guys were, you know, excited to have me, so it made me feel good that I was there. You know, I was excited to be with, you know, this great group of guys in this lineup and the pitching staff and the whole team. And, you know, just playing against them, you know, for the last couple of years, you know, well, you had to play to beat Houston. So now joining such a great team, I was just trying to be myself and fit in, you know, as fast as possible and be the best team that I could be.
Michael Brantley is joining us. So the Astros win the World Series in 2017. You know, a lot of organizations might say, that's cool. That's what we set out to do. Maybe guys get a little complacent. Maybe guys get a little fat or happy, or they start getting selfish. But from the outside, that's not how it looks. How would you describe the attitude and the mentality of that clubhouse?
Yeah, every day we show up, we expect to win, and we work hard, you know, day in and day out. That's one of the things that I think pushed me so hard this year, you know, being around such great players, you know, throughout our entire lineup. and seeing how hard they work. It only makes you want to work harder. You know, at a high level day in and day out, and what they expect and how hard our expectations are. It keeps you focused. It keeps your mind busy throughout the entire season. And, you know, it makes it fun to come to work. Hitting in the middle of this lineup, it's fun every day because you never know exactly what's going to happen, but you know that it's going to be, you know, an enjoyable game.
We're talking to Michael Brantley. Michael, I'm really happy to have you on. The connection is not great. I'm going to try and fight through this for a minute. But, you know, one of the things that keeps coming up is the fact that you are so steady and so consistent and so rock solid that no matter what happens, Joe Smith is an example. He played with you in Cleveland. He's back with you in Houston. He said, quote, he's the same guy every day, whether he's finishing third in the MVP or he's scuffling a little bit. End of quote. It's such a long season. It can be a grind. How do you manage to stay even keeled throughout the ups and downs of that long season?
Well, I just, you know, it is a long season. I know that you're going to have, you know, good stretches and bad stretches. And the more even keeled, you know, even ahead of you can stay, the better off you're going to be. This game is, you know, mental grind along as a physical grind. You got to stay focused mentally every day because you never know what's going to happen when you step on the field, but you know, with the right attitude, with the right mindset, with great teammates around you, good things are going to happen more than not.
You know, like as another example, George Springer has said that in the past, he'd been kind of a fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants guy. He would do things before games without maybe a lot of rhyme or reason, but he's taken notice of your routine, and he's learning from it. How did you first develop your pregame routine, and how important is it to have that consistency for you?
Well, for me personally, I know that if I prepare the same way every day, day in and day out, I gave my teammates all I had, and I can lay my head down, you know, in the pillow at night and go to sleep comfortable, even if I went over 5 and I didn't have the best game, because I knew I prepared the right way. For me personally, if I didn't prepare the right way, I just kind of showed up, went through the motions, and just played the game. And, you know, I didn't do it. I feel like I let my teammates down, I let my coaches down, I let, you know, my Houston Astros fans down. So for me, I just want to make sure I prepare the right day every day and go out there and give it all I got. And then with George, you know, we were just talking about routine and getting into something that makes work for him. And he's having a phenomenal year. And it's fun to watch him lead off for us every day.
We're talking to Michael Brantley. You know, you touched on your rotation. When you've got a rotation that already includes 2 Cy Young candidates, and then the front office makes a deal for Zach Greinke at the trade deadline, what kind of a message did that send everybody about how serious this whole organization is about winning another ring?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal when, you know, you set out for spring training. A lot of teams talk about it, and, you know, everybody has the same goal. But then when you add pieces like Greinke and Sanchez and Bimagini at the deadline, it just shows us how hard, you know, how dedicated they are as well, and how much they believe in us. And that goes a long way. You know, we're looking excited to finish out the season, bring the season strong, and get to the playoffs and, you know, go from there.
Michael Brantley joining us for a few more moments. Michael, what was it like to go back to the All-Star game in Cleveland and get that long-standing ovation from the fans? What kind of memories do you have of that night?
That's one of my greatest moments I ever had on a baseball field. To go back to somewhere where I gave, you know, really feeling. I played in front of those great fans for a long time, and the dedication and support they gave me through my ups and downs in my career there, it will never be forgotten. To get a standing ovation like that, just to hear the praise and the thank yous, and, you know, come back, and, you know, how much we miss you. To be around the clubbies, the doctors, the medical staff, you name it, just all the people that helped me out through my entire career to get me to this point. It was kind of just to go back there and, you know, just say thank you again for me personally. And that's, like I said, it's one of the most special moments I ever had in my career. I'll be able to tell my kids about it, my grandkids hopefully one day about it. And it was phenomenal.
Michael Brantley joining us for another moment or two. I mean, Michael, it's pretty clear how much you meant to them and how much they meant to you. Everybody who was part of the organization in Cleveland talks about how painful it was and how sad it was to lose you in the offseason. For example, Terry Francona talked about how he would probably cry when he saw you in a different jersey and how special it was to be with you for as long as you two worked together. What was it like to play for him?
It was phenomenal. You know, I thank him so much for allowing my career to blossom the way it did and grow the way it did. You know, he always expected the same thing out of me every day. I show up, you know, with the right mentality, play game. That's all I ever asked. And he made it really easy because I knew whether I did good or bad that I was in the lineup. He was always taking care of me and giving me certain days off. And, you know, the communication level was great. I had such a great relationship. He so well respected in the game for so many reasons, just not for that. And I can't thank him enough for what he did for me in my career.
Let's quickly go to Miami. Jeff in Miami. Jeff, what's going on? How are you?
Hey, Rome, you are, oh my God, bro, 13 years I've been in jungle timeout. I haven't talked to you since you were down here on terrestrial stations. It's great to be on Sirius 206 listening to you all over again. I got thrown out of a police staff meeting for making an offhand comment. Some dude at the end of the table screams, "Rack 'em." We both get thrown out. My internet gets throttled by the chief. I can't get you on anything. The TV show doesn't work out for me because, you know, kids doing things and stuff in the evening. And 12, 13 years later, I retire. Wife buys me this sick ride, says, "Go have fun, kid." So I get out in the driveway bumping through these stations on XM. Here you are. And here I am. Man, it is so good to be back in the jungle listening to you again. Thank you, Sirius XM 206. Everybody, keep it there. Rip the knob off. And I'm out.
My man, Jeff in Miami. I love that.
Good night, now.